Hello, this is Mike Swanson. I'm the author of the book, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. In a few moments, another episode of The Great Parallax Views will begin. But before it starts, let me tell you about my book. It's available at Amazon.com, The War State. It's about how the United States became a global superpower after World War II and has brought us to this situation. Grab the book at Amazon.com after the show.
I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views. On this edition of Parallax Views, master online troll and controversial rap artist Tekashi69 is being released from house arrest on August the 2nd. That's tomorrow, Sunday. Now, if you don't know about Tekashi69, well, you're going to learn all about him on this edition of Parallax Views with our special guest, Casey Gain McGalla, aka Hip Hop's The Mighty Casey. And let me tell you, it's a rather interesting story as Tekashi69 ties into the trial of the Nine Trey Gangsta Bloods and has gained a lot of hate from the hip hop community as a rat for acting as a witness in the trial. Casey, however, draws our attention to another figure in the trial who has flown under the radar, namely Christian Cruz, otherwise known as CEO Chris, who is acting as a federal informant. If that all doesn't sound intriguing to you, well, I don't know what to tell you. But I do suggest you give this episode a listen. This is some juicy true crime material that also has some socio-political ramifications. With all that being said, let's get right to the conversation with Casey Gain McGalla on the case of Tekashi69 and the trial of the Nine Trey Gangsta Bloods. Welcome back to Parallax Views. Casey Gain, aka rap legend, the mighty Casey. How are you doing, man?
I'm doing good, man. Obviously, we're still living in crazy times. As a journalist right now, all sorts of crazy times with the document dumps, which seem to be stuff that we've known for some time, and it's kind of reaching the mainstream, which is nice to kind of see cases that might have been labeled as on like the fringes or conspiratorial or outside the realm of mainstream journalism and kind of really hit the mainstream and seeing a kind of public consciousness of stuff that, you know, I've been aware of and a lot of my colleagues have been aware of for some time now, but to kind of mainstream media is ignored. So I'm doing good. Obviously, you know, COVID's going crazy. You know, election's coming up, which no one's really been thinking about or talking about. So, yeah.
Well, it is crazy times. And we're going to be talking about a bit of a crazy subject and maybe a departure from what I usually do on the show. We're going to be talking about a rapper by the name of Tekashi69, who is currently about to end his house arrest. And he's apparently very scared about that. But we'll get to that later. First, for my listeners who may be unfamiliar, who is Tekashi69 and what was your interest in his sort of case?
Tekashi69 is a Mexican-American Puerto Rican rapper from Bushwick, New York, who kind of started off on an alternative trend of hip hop. And then he linked up with an infamous New York gang called the Nine Trey Bloods. And that really kind of gave him a career trajectory to the mainstream media, to being, you know, number one on Billboard, to collaborations with Nicki Minaj, and also into jail, which he'd served about a year and a half. He informed on a number of his colleagues, and now he is back out, popular as ever, about to get off house arrest, and the subject of a lot of people's attention.
Yeah, I know a lot of people in the sort of hip-hop world really, really hate him. I mean, I listen to The Breakfast Club every once in a while, and, you know, Charlamagne the God is not a big fan. A lot of people do not like this guy.
And a lot of people do. The thing about hip-hop is it's kind of wrestling, it's entertainment, so we need our heroes and we need our villains. So, you know, when you watch Batman, some people watch Batman for Batman, other people watch it for the Joker, and I think Tekashi's kind of place himself as a Joker and, you know, as an anti-hero. And then the people who live by the Batman street code saying, oh, no, Batman, the Joker is everything that Batman is. And Batman is a real dude. He's a real rapper. He abides by a code. Batman doesn't snitch, but Tekashi does. So I think he's made for good entertainment for people, especially in a kind of semi-reality world, escapism world that is also very deeply rooted in a real world of gang violence and prison.
He's a master troll as well, I guess we should note.
He's very knows how to use the internet. And I think he kind of, as a troll, he kind of pokes fun of what hip-hop kind of really is and all these beefs and these kind of images that these kind of rappers kind of uphold. And he kind of definitely uses his sense of humor to kind of mock and belittle opponents in the same way that a wrestler would or Muhammad Ali used to kind of make a big scene and draw attention to himself, which again results in money for him, streams, paid appearances, et cetera.
Yeah, it's interesting. Maybe we should talk a little bit about how he started to get famous. But first, you know, he has a very distinctive look to him. The 69 tattooed on his head, and then, you know, the rainbow hair, obviously. When I first saw him, I was like, who is this dude and what's his deal?
Well, I guess originally you have a kind of new generations of rap kind of coinciding with Tekashi. You have a new generation of very kind of creative, young, drug-based kids who might tattoo their face. They might do weird dreads with their hair, and they're a bit of a departure from, you know, the traditional, either flossy hip hop wear, the kind of gritty, grimy hoodies and t-shirts and basic regular looks. So he's kind of representing a new generation who express themselves with their hair, with tattoos on their face, with, designer drugs and the such. So I think his hair was just a kind of way to use his body as a way to express himself creatively, and he did that with tattooing all the 6ix9ines on himself and the hair. And of course, with that, in the new internet era where image is everything and music is kind of takes a secondary role, the first most important thing an artist needs to do is get the audience's attention. And, you know, rainbow hair and all sorts of crazy tattoos and also beefs is a good way to do it.
So how does he start out? And his real name is Daniel Hernandez.
Daniel Hernandez.
Correct?
Yeah, I have, okay. I have a good friend named Daniel Hernandez. he got his start, I think, he tells people like somebody, a little rap group. And this is kind of, he's had a kind of pattern of going from group to group. And once one group of people are no longer really used to them, he jumps on another group. So this is how he kind of jumped from the Bloods to the Crips to the Bloods. So I think his story is that someone told him he looked cool, and this guy was a rapper, and the rapper kind of told him he should rap and stuff, and then he did that, and he got with one group, which was known as Scum Gang, and they were a bit more creative, they were very Wu-Tang influenced, a bit more social commentary than your traditional street rap group, but they were also Crip affiliated. So originally he got up with the Scum Gang. And when they kind of saw that he was he had a case for being involved in the molestation of a woman who was a young woman, a 13-year-old, a child who was 13 years old, and Tekashi, an associate of his, taped her while the other associate, I believe, had oral sex with her, and Tekashi might have touched her inappropriately while this was all recorded. And when they found this out, I think it caused beef between Tekashi and his old group. So, and then there's another rapper, Trippie Redd, who he had a big song with Poles, and they were friends, and then he wound up having beef with him, and he also used this kind of allegation of the pedophilia accusation and the paperwork. So he has a kind of tradition of being friends with people, getting success with them, and then when they're of no longer use, starting beef with them. And this continued throughout his career, culminating with his ultimate beef in court, in which he informed on several high-ranking members of the Nine Tray Gangsta Bloods, which is a pretty big blood gang set in New York, which is based out of the Rikers Island prison, kind of formulated there when a lot of young black people might not have had the protection they had from the Latin gangs, like Latin Kings or Dominicans Don't Play, or became a prison-based gang. And so once he associated with them, it kind of not only gave him, it was a kind of killer combination because he not only had his kind of trolling ability, but there's one thing, you know, there's one thing to talk trash and another thing to back it up. So now he could troll, but if people like one thing, like you could kind of check a troll, but most trolls will never go out in public. You'll never check them. If you ask a troll to a fight, he probably won't show up. But Tekashi became the troll who would bring, you know, like 50 gang members to a fight.
So with the child porn thing, is this before he gets famous? Is it?
Yeah, it was before he got famous.
Really? Okay.
It was initial controversy that he kind of dealt with, and he has a media friend by the name of DJ Academics, who is a kind of ringmaster for a lot of like hip hop beefs and gossip and stuff. And he actually did an interview with Academics about it, and Academics gave him, you know, some softball questions, so he was able to kind of clear it up early on in his career.
Yeah, he claims he didn't do anything. Like, he claims
he didn't touched her inappropriately, her, which is technically true. He's a master of kind of using words to kind of manipulate the truth. So he might have said he didn't rape the woman have sex with the woman, but he was involved in a sexual situation. He recorded her. He was definitely guilty of creating child porn, and he inappropriately touched the woman. This is all. He's admitted to all this.
And he got in legal trouble for that, right?
Yeah, he got on. Well, and this is what he was on probation for, which became an issue during his the early part of his rap career.
So what leads to his superstardom? Is it that music video, I think it's called Gummo?
Yeah, I mean, Gummo was when I first found out about him and when I first listened to him. And I think, again, it was a good, catchy song. It had a lot of good energy to it. And it was the fact that it was believable that he was talking all this tough stuff because he had, you know, 90 members of the Nine Tray Bloods backing up him. And at this time, he had no real affiliation with the gang. The Gummo video was actually kind of his introduction to the gang. His manager, whose name was Chris, also managed a rapper by the name of Seiko Billy. And Seiko Billy was deeply affiliated with the Nine Tray Gangsta Bloods. So I guess he arranged it that all these gangster, these Nine Tray gangsters would show up at a kind of central house, which wasn't his neighborhood. It was actually a neighborhood in Bed-Stuy, which is quite a distance away from where he's from, which is Bushwick. And it was a very close a family member of the Nine Tray Bloods where they had the house, and then all the gang members would show up, and it was kind of with the rags, and there was guns, and there was pounds of weed, and what people like in rap is authenticity. They don't want a fake version. They want a real version of what's going on in the streets, so they can kind of really feel the energy without really being there, without feeling the fear of being arrested or shot or intimidated or beat up. So I think it really provided a very gritty street feel, and it, you know, went viral both in, you know, street urban music, and it kind of went crossed over into like the suburban market. So that was his introduction to kind of rap superstardom.
And with regards to how he gets the Nine Tray Bloods involved, you said he just met sort of one person and they set it up, or what? Well, it just seems weird that they would allow themselves to be in the video.
His manager also managed a prominent member of the Nine Tray Bloods, whose name is Seiko Billy, also a rapper. Tekashi actually directed a video for Seiko Billy. Through Seiko Billy, he got introduced to a gentleman by the name of Kafano Jordan, who also went by the name Shoddy. Mm-hmm. And Shoddy was a very high-ranking member of the Nine Tray Bloods. under another member by the name of Mel Murder, Mel Matrix, who was affiliated with another rapper by the name of Jim Jones, and who's in Jim Jones' group, Bird Gang. So through them, he meets Shoddy. Shoddy sees potential for him to make money with Tekashi. He sees a kind of, he sees that this kid has a popularity to him, and he sees a way that he could kind of enter the rap game, perhaps become, get a legitimate source of income outside of whatever gang-related income he might have been making before. So Shoddy was his original kind of like cosign, his like lefty from Donnie Brasco, if you will. Shoddy kind of brought him in, became his like right-hand man, became his so-called manager or protector, or just, you know, they were very close for some time.
And so, I was going to say, after Gummo becomes a sleeper hit, he does a mixtape that gets on the Billboard Hot 100.
We did a lot of other songs. He did a song, Kiki, and all these songs, he kind of revisited the formula of going to, like, tough urban gang-infested neighborhoods, showing off, like, the gang culture, showing off the toughness of these gangs, the kind of... The interesting fear of it. So he would keep on going to these hoods, shoot videos with large amounts of gang members. And this was a formula originally till he kind of did the song with Nicki Minaj. And then he kind of went to a more pop formula after that. And then by that time, he was already beginning to kind of split with the Nine Tray Bloods, who were the main gang element in most of these early videos. So he had a series of ones. I think one was called Kuda. Another one might have been called Kiki, and all these videos, very similar in tone to Gummo, very, you know, angry street-related content. And the videos also were very similar in tone to Gummo, with a lot of heavy gang presence, legality, very, you know, toughness, very New York.
Now, a sidebar here. You mentioned the whole authenticity aspect of hip-hop. I've always found that interesting because I get the impression at one point in hip hop, you know, there was a lot of sort of character play. Like a rapper like Paris could play, you know, the sort of thug persona, but really right. Paris was some guy that was, you know, educated in economics at a major university. I've heard people say the same for Tupac early on, that he was sort of portraying a character at first. Maybe he became that character a little bit. It seems like the stakes are much higher now. You really have to.
You're kind of marketing a person more than you're marketing their music. So if you're marketing someone's music, you know, they could have their own character play because it's that body of work that defines them. But right now, I think labels, especially since, you know, Biggie and Tupac and their beef, they want to market the individuals and not necessarily their music, and they market the music second. So you want to market these people, and beef is a great way to market people. So if you have a rapper who has a feud with another rapper, that's a way that they get in the news, they get in the hip hop blogs, they get attention outside of the music world. So a lot of labels definitely want to invest in rap that will sell, rap that will cause controversy, rappers that will beef each other, rappers that have real gang authenticity. It's like you don't want to, it's different from a movie, you know. I don't think anyone's really concerned that De Niro is not really a member of the mafia, or, you know, or Arnold Schwarzenegger isn't really a cyborg. But for hip hop, where people really want realness, you know, especially if you think about it, you know, I would say, you know, obviously like 70% of consumers of hip hop are not poor or black. They're, you know, they're suburban white people, and it's a kind of escapism. It's kind of the same reason you might watch a gangster movie, or the same reason you might watch wrestling, is why you're listening to hip hop now, because you want that base level entertainment. You want that beef. You want that toughness. You want the kind of clashes of personalities. You want brashness. So I think that's, and Tekashi definitely was just like a wrestler, just like how, you know, Hulk Hogan would like troll Randy Macho Man Savage, or the wrestlers would hype up an event by talking trash about each other and make the kind of the clash all the more interesting for people. And a lot of the time, but Tekashi, there would be no wrestlers. It was just kind of the trash talk, and you never really got to see the big wrestling moment.
Now, what's his background? What's the real background of Daniel Hernandez? Is he, you know, from the sort of tough streets, or is he?
He's from Bushwick, which is a tough neighborhood. He was from a gentrifying Bushwick. I think he worked at a tattoo shop, so he was definitely not a, you know, a suburban kid on ice pretending. But he definitely wasn't a gang member either. He was a hipster kid living in New York. He might have, you know, sold drugs or anything, but he had no deep gang affiliations. I doubt he engaged in too many violent activities. But, you know, poor working class kid, you know, single mom. There's been differing stories about, was his father killed? His father's still alive. Man, a stepfather who was killed.
So, in that regard, this relationship with the Nine Trey Bloods, maybe you can give a little bit more background on the Nine Trey Bloods in case I have listeners that are unfamiliar with this sort of gang world.
Well, the Nine Trey Bloods were formed in 1993. That's how they got their name, Nine Trey, in Rikers Island. I believe there was a West Coast Blood member who found his way to New York and became incarcerated at Rikers Island, which is an infamous. It's not a prison, it's a jail where you go when you're arrested before you're in trial and convicted. It's a very, very tough place. It's a lot of violence. It's a lot of ethnic and racial-based violence, a lot of gang activity. So came out of Rikers Island during the crack era where you had the beginnings of mass incarceration coming up with Bill Clinton, where not only were you having people arrested for legitimate harsh crimes that were coming out of the crack era, murder, but you also had a lot of people arrested for nonviolent offenses, not only selling of crack, but smoking weed, selling weed, trespassing. So you had a mass influx of young black men, maybe they between the ages of 16 and 20, in a Lord of the Flies kind of crazy environment where in order to survive, you needed to kind of join a gang. So because of, you know, pop culture going on the outside, mass incarceration going on in New York, you've had this jail-based gangs, which rather in New York, most gangs would be kind of neighborhood-based. So if you lived in Brooklyn and you're from Bed-Stuy and your block was Madison, that would be your clique, your gang. But now if you're a Nine Trey Gangster Blood, you're going to have offsets in the Bronx, if you're in Brooklyn, Queens, everywhere, because Rikers Island takes everybody from all of New York, puts them all again. So, and there was a kind of crazy, I don't know how much of it was media hype, how much real of a kind of scare of the Bloods kind of reaching New York in the 90s and slashing people's faces and such. And then, of course, it's been continued on through music groups like Dipset, which consists of Cam'ron, Jim Jones, and Joel Santana, have kind of promoted blood use in New York. There's been other rappers. Bobby Shmurda, a recent popular rapper, was a kind of an offset of a Crip use. So what has kind of happened with the kind of Bloods and Crips becoming like the Burger King and McDonald's of gangs is that before you might have like small little franchises, but now these franchises kind of connect to a bigger gang. And they still, you might have beef between Bloods. Like a lot was going on with Tekashi was beef between his Blood set and other Blood sets, whether they be another Blood set in Flatbush with Casanova and the Apes, or they be a Blood set in LA with Slim 400 and YG. So it's so the kind of spreading of kind of Blood and Crip culture, which also occurred because of, you know, mass incarceration, and then you kind of had a mass popularization of hip hop, you know, Snoop Dogg and The Game and all these kind of either Blood or Crip affiliated rappers were marketed as Bloods and Crips with the colors and everything like that, kind of almost to make it kind of seem cool. And
Death Row so Records type of stuff, right?
Right. So you had a kind of joint effect of mass poverty, mass incarceration, a group of young minority males who are shut out of mainstream America with no chance of, you know, getting a real job because they've been incarcerated since they were 16. And gang life becomes a good option, especially with the kind of rise in drug culture and the profitability of drug dealing and later scamming, which is going on a lot now with gangs.
So I know there's always the people talk about the fights between the Bloods and the Crips, but you're saying there's also sort of internecine fights between Bloods and other Bloods. What's that all about?
Well, I mean, some of it is kind of hip-hop driven, and some of it is just natural causes, effects of criminality and gangs when you have so many different sets of some bloods. You know, it's not like they're gonna have a big blood Crip civil war and every blood set is gonna unite under the common blood banner and every Crip set is gonna unite under the common Crip banner, because these groups have issues within themselves, not only through hip hop. I think, and one of the beefs, which was with a Flatbush-based gang. So Flatbush is another part of Brooklyn, separate from Bushwick and Bed-Stuy. There was a group named, there was a rapper by the name of Casanova, who, you know, he kind of, I think he saw that Tekashi wasn't a gangster from quickly on, and he made a song and alluded to it and labeled it Tekashi 6ix9ine disc, because I think he might have realized, like, this kid isn't a real gangster, which was correct. And, but I think the 9 Trade, they took offense to that because they saw him as their meal ticket and him kind of violating that. And I think there was also other beefs between the Flatbush gang, I think known as the Apes, and the 9 Trey blood. So it can be over women, can be over money, can be over territory. There isn't, with the kind of, it's just gangs. And again, it's kind of, you know, it's just that the Bloods and Crips just kind of franchise different gangs. And going on in New York right now, you're having Bloods and Crips are linking up against GDs because New York was traditionally such a neighborhood-based place, they get to franchise out. So even the Gangster Disciples, which is a gang out of Chicago, is also even spread to New York. And they're kind of, so it's a mix of neighborhoods, jails, and kind of gangs franchising out, the big gangs from LA and Chicago, going to New York, which never had big gangs because there was always so many small neighborhood gangs.
Now, you mentioned that a lot of these gang beefs can end up being revolving around hip hop itself. It's funny because a lot of this is like new to me. I'm into like the older rap, like I listen to like School ED and stuff like that. But someone said to me when I mentioned Tekashi 6ix9ine, they said, "Oh, he got bopped by the hip hop police."
I mean, there's definitely a hip hop police, and they've been around for a while. I think with as blatant as he was, I don't think you needed a kind of secret hip hop police to kind of catch him. I think right now going on is a lot of people are so like flagrant on social media, but there is a hip hop police who follow around big name rappers and they keep files on them. There were files on them, but I think with him, I think it was definitely just a lot of flagrant activity kind of in order to become popular that really got him in trouble. Like a lot that's, and There was an investigation into his gang way before he even joined them in terms of them doing stuff like fentanyl. There was another big informant in his case by the name of Christian Cruz, Christian with a K, who also went by the name CEO Chris. And this guy is the kind of weird informant. He seemed to have a lot of money. He was offering to sign rappers. He was giving members of the gang chains, you know, expensive diamond chains. He was also supplying them with fentanyl, and he was also a government informant, which is kind of weird for me because the way I thought of the way criminal investigations work is that your goal is to get the big drug dealer who's supplying everybody, right? But in this case, they had the big drug dealer who's supplying everybody as the informant rather than the small criminals. So the big drug dealer who's supplying everybody gives up the smaller little drug dealers. So, and it's really not clear like how this guy, Christian Cruz, had money, how he had all these cars, how he had all these chains, how he had all these, was the government supporting him while he was selling him drugs? Was the government giving him money? Did they turn a blind eye to him selling a deadly drug by the name of fentanyl, which he was importing from China, which causes, you know, thousands of overdoses, and also mass addiction. So that was the kind of interesting part about the case to me that kind of got overlooked by the media, that the government had Tekashi, who was kind of trying to cause tensions between the group. Some of the tensions between the group. So eventually, like the rise and fall of Tekashi is that, you know, Kafano Jordan became closest to him, and he became probably the most financially secure off his relationship off him. But other members of the gang resented that. So there was a gentleman by the name of Anthony Harv Ellison and another gentleman by the name of Al Jeremiah Nuke Mack, And so these guys kind of had a splitter with the group, and they wound up kidnapping Tekashi 6ix9ine because they felt he disrespected them when he kind of went to go join Kafano Jordan, also known
Kafano
as
Kafano is Shoddy. Okay. Kafano okay. Jordan yeah.
So there was a split in this group, but if you look at other court transcripts, one of the persons trying to bring this split in this group is Christian Cruz, CEO Chris, who's in these one gang member's ears telling him that these guys are cockroaches, and he's another gang member's ears talking about these guys aren't bad. These guys, you know, trying to talk bad among members and bring tension to the group that kind of led to the kidnapping. So I don't know if you had some type of agent, provocateur, informant, but it seems like the government's informant was the most deadly person out of all, who was, you know, selling the most, you know, deadly drug, had the most money, seems to have the most power. I mean, this guy was their guy, and he got free before Tekashi. He didn't have to do any time. Tekashi at least had to do a year and some change.
Well let's Christian back up here. Let's back up real quickly. What leads to the downfall, not just of Tekashi, but I mean the Nine Trey Bloods? How does the trial come about? What went down for listeners that may be unfamiliar?
Well, I mean, I think the downfall started even before Tekashi joined them, and I think that Nine Trey was probably on their way down. It was just, you know, the government kind of picks and chooses how to do things. A lot of times the government wants to make a show because they want to show, you know, it's more important than actually crime prevention is for the government to kind of show they're preventing crime and to get a big bust. So I think the gang, you know, there's been Nine Trey gang members have been locked. And it happens all the time, but it's not big news because there's no rappers affiliated with them. So the moment, I would say maybe, they were doing hot stuff from the beginning, man. They were having shootouts. They were, Tekashi was on camera offering to put $30,000 for a hit on another rapper on camera. And that rapper was later shot at. So I think they might've been doomed from the beginning, but I think Tekashi, you know, he definitely was able to get a great deal for himself by serving only a bit of a time and actually raising his public profile.
What did they get busted for, though, I guess, if people
A number of things. Well, I mean, different people for different things. There was the violent acts. There was a shooting at the Barclays Center, which was a confrontation with Casanova's crew. There was another armed robbery in which Tekashi robbed some of his former colleagues of a backpack and other goods, and that was caught on camera. There was the shooting of Chief Keef, which Tekashi put the money on. There was a number of other shootings involving Harv Ellison. There was the kidnapping, which, of course, Harv Ellison went for. Kafano Jordan was involved in a number of shootings to protect Tekashi, which is interesting. And then he goes on and gives all the years. So racketeering, gun violence, armed robbery, attempted murder. Mostly racketeering, and that's the way. And it's interesting how the RICO Act, Racketeering Act, was originally to get like big mafia people. So if you can't get John Gotti, the biggest guy, you know, because he's has such a strong organizational structure that he's never going to be in the room with the drugs and never be in the room with the money. You're going to never catch him on the phone making a hit. But it's being used more for like small gangs. A lot of gangs of people of color, which not too much power, maybe selling a little bit of weed, bit of crack here and there, and they're used with the RICO Act to kind of get rid of these gangs. So it was a lot of it was RICO, and if you're a member, so if I'm a member of a gang and my fellow gang members commit murder, I'm guilty of part of that racketeering. So racketeering, armed robberies, a lot of this stuff. There's a pretty good podcast called Infamous, in which a friend of mine, Sean Sotero, kind of, he's actually in the court, kind of do it, and it kind of goes into all the acts they actually did get caught for, a number of violent acts, none deadly, but an armed robbery, shootings, fights, et cetera. And Tekashi, and also drugs too, which was kind of, Tekashi even admitted to kind of brokering a kilo deal of heroin, and a lot of them, especially CEO Chris, got the other guys for selling fentanyl. Even, you know, he's the plug. So, you know, you got guys like Kafano Jordan, Mel Murder, who's Jamel Jones. And these guys who, you know, sold a small amount of fentanyl, did a lot of years, but their main plug, the government informant, didn't do any time for it.
This is CEO Chris that was the government informant.
Right.
He doesn't really serve any time, is what you're saying.
No time at all.
Wow.
No.
So that's interesting then. And I want to know, I think, how many people were involved in the case? It's like 11 different people went down?
Maybe 15 people wound up serving time over the case, over Takashi's testimony, CEO Chris's testimony.
Okay, so CEO Chris is sort of ignored in all of this. Why is the focus on Takashi? Is it just because
he's a big rap star? And that's where, I mean, if this case were to happen without Takashi, you probably would have had a CEO Chris or whoever, the big government informant, whoever, and it would have been, you know, totally glossed over. But I think that definitely, you know, there's definitely some type of cooperation going on between the government and the media when they use these informants. And when I looked at his Instagram, it seems like he still might even be trying to be a government informant. He might still, I mean, I found a thread, and they had a thread of this guy doing, like, with every gang member, doing their gang signs, doing this. So he's infiltrated, like, several gangs. And, well, I'm guessing with the kind of allure of being the plug and having access to all this fentanyl. But there's been pictures of him with Bloods, Crips, Latin Kings, like, definitely trying to infiltrate a bunch of gangs. And there's, yeah, the history, I think, like, even 2 years ago, I think he was arrested in a big racketeering case. 2013, it was another one, and it for big-time drug dealing. So he's the kind of interesting missing piece to the puzzle. And I think when we go back to, like, how the government fights crime, it's really for show and not for actually getting drugs off the street or making any change. And I think that's kind of what we've seen with him. You know, you have a guy with no moral compass who can deal drugs, and the government would rather get gang members in jail than get these drugs out the street and get these big time drug dealers off the street.
Well, because it justifies their existence, right? They can say, oh, look, we made a big bust, but they needed the informant to make the big bust for them. So they let him go. They keep making busts. And they can say, yeah, oh, we did a good job.
The Whitey Bulgers, and then the informants become the people with more of the power, you know, especially if they were powerful criminals before. And rather than the government using the criminals wind up using the government. Or they wind up using each other because they both kind of have the same goal of criminality.
Right, right, right. Yeah, Whitey Bulger is a good example of that. I think there was Gregory Scarpa's another one. There's a lot of cases like this, even in like the mafia world. So that's really interesting. I guess what I want to get to is everyone focuses on Takashi, and they're like, he was a Fed all along. What is your take on that?
He was definitely not a Fed all along. Okay. He was a kid who wanted attention and would do anything for attention and would risk anything for attention, including jail or getting beat up. CEO Chris was a Fed all along.
So
Takashi, I don't think there's an elaborate plot for him to take down a small gang by creating a huge rap career.
So this kid's in over his head. He does become an informant, right?
An informant is someone who actively, like, if I was an informant, I would be actively, like, talking to my criminal friends and getting information from them rather than being someone who testifies against them, which is a little bit different than being a government informant. I'm trying to think of a witness. So he definitely was a government witness against the people. But I think he was facing 47 years. He claims that Shadi Cafano Jordan had sex with the mother of his child. He also claimed that Shadi Cafano Jordan was, you know, robbing him of money. So that was his reason for kind of snitching on him. Obviously, Anthony Harv Mack Ellison kidnapped him, so he didn't have to have too much incentive to want to testify against the person who kind of kidnapped him during his life.
You know, I want to note, too, I always forget. This is, like, a pretty young kid. He's 24. I always forget
that.
Yeah,
I think he's 23 now, but when he got into it, he might have been, like, 20. Mm-hmm. 19, 20.
Yeah. So you would say he's a government witness. Is it just because he's afraid of the time he's going to serve? You know, he wants his freedom.
I mean, it's a number. So, I mean, that's the natural thing to do, I think, for human beings. If you're kind of pressure is it's you or you other people to give up. One of the things that stopped people from this has been like the mafia having like a strong moral code of not doing it. So I out of my moral code, I'm going to take off my natural instinct of self-preservation. And rather than thing to preserve myself, I'm going to preserve my entity, my gang. So I'm going to put my gang before my personal self or my mafia or my family. Like, would I, you know, tell on my family? Probably not. You know what I mean? Would I tell on some random people or my coworkers? Probably, you know? So the reason he told on him was, A, yeah, he's facing years. And he was never really a gang member. He never really had that kind of loyalty or bond that gang members or mafia people have or code. And a lot of people don't. A lot of the biggest criminals, most famous criminals, Frank Lucas, Sammy the Bull Gravano, number of Latin drug dealers have all turned informants because it was A, self-preservation. So self-preservation, animosity against the gang. I think he felt he kind of was used, which he was, and he was using them. And so that's why he told. I mean, I'd be surprised if he didn't tell. I'd be super surprised if he didn't. It seemed like a natural reaction from his person to his character. And person to most people's characters, I think most people would do that, unless you're a real hardcore gang member and you really believe in this code and you really view these people you're asking to turn in as your family.
Okay, so why do you think the sort of hip-hop community looks at him and says, because I've heard multiple people say, oh, he had to have been a Fed all along. Why do you think there's such a reaction against him and not C.O.
Chris? Well, not many people know who C.O. Chris is. You know, C.O. Chris isn't a rapper. Chris. Because of the public personality and because Tekashi invites controversy. He wants it. He wants you to hate on him. And people kind of fall into the trap. So I think hip-hop is like an imaginary. If I want to be close to the streets, right, I don't want to go to the streets and risk being shot at or going arrested. But I could feel the streets. So people who listen to rap, they feel they know like what's going on. They feel they know about a snitching code, like even though they've never been involved in any tragedy. So in the imaginary world of hip hop, you know what I'm saying? Like snitching is not tolerated, right? So that's a kind of super taboo. First one, especially in the gang world, you know, especially in the mafia based, Blood and Crip based, never sell out your homies, fuck the cops world, you know, you don't cooperate with the enemy. So that's a kind of general attitude hip hop has already. And for him to do it and be kind of proud of it. And again, it's like I said before, people need their villains. And he realizes this. Like he'll wear that badge, you know, of being a snitch, like a badge of honor, because he realizes that's what's gonna get him attention.
Now I guess the other reason I think I've heard some people get really conspiratorial about Tekashi and say, oh, he was a Fed all along, is because it does seem like he got a bit of a nicer deal out of this, especially because he's on house arrest. But I understand that's because of, I guess he has asthma and they didn't want him in prison during the COVID pandemic.
Yeah, there's been a lot of people and a lot of people are frustrated. I mean, this is a crazy thing going on. And some people are accrediting this to the rise of crime rate in a lot of places, including New York City. But it's not just him. A lot of people have been let out of jail early because of COVID-related things. So if it was just him, I could see it some sort of conspiratorial angle, but there's been a rash of release of prisoners due to COVID in the past few months. So
now, what do you think is going to happen?
I think he would just do out to be in November. He might have got like 6 months off or something like
right,
that.
Right, right. Well, okay, so that brings us to what is going to happen now, because I think his house arrest it's going to end on Sunday, August the 2nd, and it sounds like he is, worried about that.
I think his moment has kind of came and gone, and unfortunately, I think it's 15 minutes. It's kind of coming up, unless he could find another kind of narrative. It's going to be hard. I mean, the way most people, musicians, make money is really touring, and I don't know if he's going to be able to tour. I mean, I think he'll be able to tour Europe fine. That would be great. Might be harder to him to do any, like, a lot of like, hip-hop is based on, like, joint bills and touring with other artists. I don't know if any other artists would want to tour with him. I think his novelty is going to wear off a little bit. And the fact that he doesn't have all these gang members to back him up, and the fact that he's just kind of, you know, we know this. There's no altercation is going to happen. He's just talking trash. He's really just an internet troll now. rather than being a kind of gangster. So I don't know what's going to happen next, but I kind of see the story coming to a bit of an end and him winning and losing in the same point.
Do you think the reports of him being, you know, scared for his life after his house arrest ends are sort of him trolling around, or?
I think he's telling the police he's scared for his life. I think that's where you get better protection. I don't know if he's scared for his life. I think if he has decent enough protection, I don't know. People forget about this stuff, man. And there's informants walking the street right now. No one's shooting them. No one's killing them. I don't know. If he's feared for his life, he has reason to be. He's starting enough beefs. But if you're just going to stay at home, I don't know if anyone's going to run to his home and give him a home invasion and risk going to jail and risking their own life just to get a chance at possibly hurting or touching or killing him. So I don't know.
So anything else we want to say about the Tekashi 6ix9ine case before we start wrapping up and maybe moving on to this documentary series you were telling me about?
Nothing really. I think we really need to look at it in a way that our criminal justice system works and doesn't work in terms of how the government uses informants who actually deal drugs and kind of create crime. And I think we need to start thinking of ways as a society where we could stop gang violence. And as a way, we see how mass incarceration is not a kind of way to prevent gang violence, but it kind of increases it, especially when you're arresting nonviolent drug offenders and they're coming out violent gang-related offenders. So I think we need to start looking at as kind of society, the society problems of how we eliminate gang violence, maybe ending the war on drugs, trying to add a new look at mass incarceration, trying to have a change the way police reform in terms of the way they use informants and put it on a bigger focus on getting rid of the people who are really poisoning. I'm a person who would say, focus on the violent drug offenses. When you have something like fentanyl, which is killing people left and right, and people are fighting over it and dying and killing over it for it, you really need to kind of nip in the bud drug addiction and these big drug suppliers, and also provide resources for addicts so we don't have a society that is run by drug dealers and criminals. And we also need other opportunities for young people of color in cities so they aren't drawn to these gangs and we don't see these type of problems. And obviously the media too, the way we kind of portray gang violence, it needs to change. It needs to stop being glamorized, both in hip hop culture and mainstream culture.
Yeah, I was going to add to that. The fentanyl crisis is really bad. I mean,
horrible.
You know, just I've known people who were involved in you know, they did heroin and then they went to fentanyl, and it's a killer. And you know, I don't think the war on drugs has done anything to stop this. If anything, it's added to the problem.
It's definitely added to the problem, and we have a massive opioid epidemic, a massive, I think, the highest mortality rate through drugs of all time, and it's crazy. And the media is not paying attention to it because, you know, big pharma sponsors all big media, and I think we definitely need to look at fentanyl as a big time problem, and start thinking ways to.
What's your just out of curiosity? What's your opinion on how to deal with the opioid crisis? Because my personal view, and I know this is controversial, is I don't think it should be treated as a crime. I don't think users should.
I think opioids should be legalized just like how marijuana is, and then regulated it, so some type of FDA. So you know, if an addict is getting a pill or whatever, they know it's not cut with fentanyl and angel dust and other stuff. And obviously that's not going to eliminate overdoses, but I do think it would reduce them greatly. And start thinking of ways for treatment. I think there needs to be a real big change in terms of how America and American people kind of view themselves. I feel like drug addiction is a side effect of depression. I think it is a side effect of mental problems. I think it's a problem of a kind of bad society that isn't working, where people aren't giving opportunities to do things. I think when you have societies where people are actively engaged and passionate about what they do in life, they're a lot less susceptible to fall into drug addiction. So I really feel like America needs a kind of big reboot in the way we think, the way we approach employment, the way we approach housing, and the way we approach mental health.
I agree 110%. I know you wanted to talk about this Iran-Contra documentary. And real quick, so this CO Chris guy, he's still on Instagram. People can find him.
On Instagram, yep. Wow. I think he's even using his Instagram, which is like all sorts of balling pictures with chains and everything like that. And I think it's older pictures, but he's still posting. And wow. I think he's still trying to lure drug dealers in who might not have paid attention to the case.
So this documentary, tell me about this documentary.
It's a really good documentary called The Last Narc. And it's all about the death of Kiki Camarena. So if anyone who's ever watched Narcos Mexico, the first season and the second season have dealt with the death of a Mexican-American DEA agent by the name of Kiki Camarena. Now, if you watch Narcos, you would think that he was caught up by the corrupt Mexican police and the Narcos, and then they tortured him and killed him. But if you watch this documentary, they directly blame a man by the name of Felix Rodriguez, who was a former CIA agent, Brigade 2506 veteran. The man a lot of people blame on the death of Che Guevara. So they claim that Felix Rodriguez was interrogating Kiki Camarena to find out what he knew about the CIA's involvement in Iran-Contra and the drug trade back then before he was killed. So this is a really huge amount of significance. And if you watch the way, you know, documentaries kind of change the kind of public climate, like when you had the Jeffrey Epstein documentary, now everyone knew about it on Netflix. Next thing you get Ghislaine Maxwell getting arrested. You had the R. Kelly documentary, and then the next thing you know, you had a big public outcry. R. Kelly gets arrested, Harvey Weinstein, you know. So I'm really hoping that this documentary can lead to some sort of public outcry in terms of the CIA really, because there's been obviously, this is stuff like Epstein that stuff like myself, yourself, a lot of people have said for years, there's been multiple credible accusations and evidence of the CIA being involved in the drug trade to support the Contras in Nicaragua. And that these are the same drugs that poisoned Black America during the 1980s and led to the kind of crack epidemic.
I was going to say, you can even go back to the Vietnam era with Alfred McCoy's book, which isn't really even, it's not a conspiracy book, The Politics of Heroin.
What's it called again?
The Politics of Heroin, yeah.
Right, yeah. Yeah, and even if you go back with Felix Rodriguez, he was working with Ted Shackley in Vietnam, so doing the same. So what happened in Vietnam was kind of, or more Laos and Cambodia, was replicated in Central America, in which the same people, Felix Rodriguez, Ted Shackley, the kind of same cell of CIA agents closely associated to George H.W. Bush. And the documentary also goes into the fact that Felix Rodriguez was a very close friend of George H.W. Bush, called his office a lot of times, met with them, signed pictures. There was all sorts of documents saying that they went back to their CIA days. And I don't know if those were the days when Bush was the head of the CIA in 76. I think those goes back to when George Bush was a CIA agent slash oilman in the 60s during the JFK assassination era. But so this is a really big documentary. I really hope everyone spreads it. I think it will hopefully lead to opening the floodgates of the involvement of what the CIA was really doing in Central America, in Mexico, in America, regarding the cocaine trade and the murders and the deceitful things they did to cover it up. This is a CIA agent being complicit in the interrogation. He actually interrogated him. So if this was a criminal case, and I don't see why it shouldn't be, and if there was any sense of justice in the United States, if you had one lone Jim Garrison type or Southern District type who's not afraid to go against the Epsteins, if you had any type of person in the United States with a job in the legal community, he should be persecuted right now for the murder, interrogation, and torture of Kiki Camarena. Felix Rodriguez should be sitting in a cell with Ghislaine Maxwell right now. And also, why don't you start asking about the drug trade? And it's really so unfortunate that George H.W. Bush died before he could face a jury of his own peers for his numerous crimes, going back to the JFK assassination, Watergate, Iran-Contra, again, also involved in CIA heroin trafficking out of, and it's his clique that he's the head of, like, Wexner might be the head of the snake for the Epstein organization. George H.W. Bush was the head of the snake for Iran-Contra. And you will see that with Felix Rodriguez. And I really hope everyone watches this documentary, spreads it, and we really need to get a public outcry that spreads. And I would love to see the arrest of Felix Rodriguez. Two of his friends, Orlando Bosch and Luis Posada Carrias, both died in Miami as heroes, free and safe, after numerous acts of terrorism, including the bombing of a plane leaving Barbados for Cuba that killed 83 civilians. Numerous other civilians died in acts of terrorism. Numerous other murders in the name of narco trafficking. Numerous kilos being sold that flooded the streets of America. Like, if you look at, if you go back to Felix Rodriguez, if anybody, you know, reads books like I really read books, if you read Compromise by Terry Reed, Felix Rodriguez, a.k.a. Max Gomez, figures heavily in that book as also being involved in Arkansas. So for all the people who are involved in the kind of Bill Clinton, Barry Seal stuff, you also see the connection between, that the documentary doesn't go into, between Felix Rodriguez and Barry Seal. If you look at what L.D. Brown says, who was one of Bill Clinton's former aides who he brought into the CIA, who also said that Felix Rodriguez was running dope out of Mexico back then. So this is multiple corroborated accusations, which the documentary doesn't go into, that Felix Rodriguez, Mr. CIA, Mr. Bay of Pigs, Mr. George H.W. Bush buddy, was running a lot of cocaine out of Guadalajara, Mexico, after they kind of shut down Barry Seal's operation in Arkansas.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I just had Bob Fitrakis on, and we were talking about the Iran-Contra connection to Les Wexner. And I mean, at best, what you have going on is, like, the feds are just – this is at best, right? At best, they're looking the other way on all this drug dealing.
And at worst, which is what I really believe at worst, is that George H.W. Bush was organizing it, saying, let's run these drugs. Who gives a fuck about the black community? There's stuff in Chip Tatum's files in which Barry Seal says, hey, they just want to just get these drugs to the black community and get the niggas locked up for them. These are, Chip Tatum is saying that Barry Seal said to him. So I think you have to be very gullible to believe that they were not just turning a blind eye rather than being actively involved in this trafficking, if not controlling it. I think there was a gentleman by the name of Al Miller who wrote a book, and he said that Oliver North was controlling the price for a kilo. So that means you have to have so much power in the drug trade to, that's like oil. You have to be OPEC to set the price for oil, right? You have to. So during the 1980s, Oliver North had so much power in the drug trade, he could set the price for a kilo that would affect the black market all over the United States.
I was going to say real quick, I think the name you were thinking about was Al Martin, who wrote The Conspirator's Secrets of an Iran-Contra Insider.
Sorry about that.
I guess what the only reason I brought up the best case scenario was that people, I mean, there are still people that crap on Gary Webb. And I've always told them, I'm like, you know, it's one of two things. Either it's the best case scenario he was right about, or the worst case. And either way, it's not good. So I think Gary Webb should get his day of retribution.
And I think if anything, that this movie or this documentary definitely is the kind of missing piece to it. Because I think obviously, and when you deal with allegations of sex and drugs, very hard to prove. There's going to be a lot of allegations, and there's going to be some people lying, some people telling the truth. So it's not, you're not going to have like a documented Felix Rodriguez buying 50 keys on his debit card with a receipt. You know what I'm saying? So you might have an old narco saying, yes, he did. And then you have Felix Rodriguez maybe denying. But once you have such a pattern of people willing to go out and say this stuff, it's really hard to deny. And you see the cause and effects of these things. It's really horrible. I really hope that this can come with some legal retribution against the CIA. I really hope that maybe some communities of color affected by the crack epidemic could really sue the CIA and the government for direct restitutions for the evil that they've caused in the community while incarcerating. And people like Bill Clinton, you know, who was involved with the CIA in Arkansas and then also involved in incarceration. It was really horrible.
What's the big Clinton book?
The Compromise by Terry Reed is a good one. Compromise by Terry Reed is not necessarily, it's, there's Partners in Power by, who's my guy again? There's a few.
No, I was thinking, wasn't there one, The Boys on the Tracks with
that Maria was by Mara Levitt?
Yeah,
that was. There's so there's so many little Clintons. There tangentially were the Clintons involved, like in Terry Reid's book Compromise. If you look at the Chip Tatum's, the Tatum Chronicles, Boy Clinton, I think was written by a right wing author, but he also extensively interviewed L.D. Brown, who was a former Clinton aide turned CIA agent. So there's numbers of credible accusations of which also involve Felix Rodriguez, connecting Felix Rodriguez to Bill Clinton, Barry Seal, Luis Posada Carriles, kind of interesting little nexus of CIA agents, ex-CIA agents, anti-Castro Cubans, and narco traffickers.
Well, hey, Casey, I want to thank you again for coming on Parallax Views. How can my listeners keep up with your work?
Thank you. I highly recommend, especially now with the Last Narc documentary, I highly recommend everyone read my book, Inside the CIA, Seymour in Jamaica. I went into great detail about Felix Rodriguez and his history and his connection to Luis Posada Carriles, who was involved in Jamaica, and Orlando Bosch. So definitely buy my book. I highly recommend everyone, you know, do a big, good Google research on Felix Rodriguez. You can catch me on Twitter at Casey Gain, Instagram, Casey Gain. So that's for, you know, the political side. I really feel like my book is more relevant now than ever, and I really feel that I did a great job kind of exposing the CIA's involvement in narco trafficking, and I'm really hoping this documentary kind of, because it's so crazy, because I could write a million books and do a million podcasts, and no one will take it seriously, but the minute, like, Amazon and Netflix is a documentary, they're like, oh, it must be true. Yeah, so I'm really hoping now that people see this, so go on. I really feel the biggest thing I'm pushing right now would be my book, and even if you're not interested in Jamaica, there's 2-3 big chapters, 30-40 pages, just on the kind of CIA, anti-Castro Cuban Bay of Pigs nexus to the drug trade, which lasted from the JFK assassination, also Iran Contra.
Well, thank you again, Casey Gain, for coming on Parallax Views.
Thank you.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Casey Gain Magala, aka the Mighty Casey, and author of Inside the CIA's Secret War in Jamaica. Let me know what you thought about this edition of Parallax Views by dropping me a line on Twitter at ViewsParallax or by email at parallaxviewspod@protonmail.com. And, of course, if you can, please consider supporting me on Patreon at patreon.com/parallaxviews. Producers credit shoutouts to Amelia, Mark, Martin, Brace, and John. Please consider joining them at the $10 Patreon tier if you'd like your own producer shoutout on the next edition of Parallax Views. You can do that by signing up at patreon.com/parallaxviews. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxieties, problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight. With no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.